You're listening to WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3 WBTV.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a new interview with Vermont children's author Lida Schubert, whose new book is Listen, How Pete Seeger Got America Singing, published by Roaring Brook Press. Lida Schubert has played traditional music since childhood. She is the author of Roaring Brook Press's The Princess of Borscht, Ballet of the Elephants, and Monsieur Marceau, which won NCTE's Orbis Pictus Award for Excellence in Nonfiction, and the Norman A. Sugarman Children's Biography Award. She lives in Plainfield, Vermont, with her husband and two dogs. Here's a little information about her book. Listen, there was nobody like Pete Seeger. Wherever he went, he got people singing. With his head thrown back and his Adam's apple bouncing, picking his long-necked banjo, or strumming his 12-string guitar, Pete sang old songs, new words to old songs, and songs he made up. In this gorgeously written and illustrated tribute to legendary musician and activist Pete Seeger, author Lida Schubert highlights major musical events in Mr. Seeger's life, as well as important moments of his fight against social injustice. From singing sold-out concerts to courageously standing against the McCarthy-era finger-pointing, Pete Seeger's life is celebrated in this bold book for young readers with gorgeous illustrations by Raul Colon. When I spoke with Lida last week, I asked her how she came to write Listen, How Pete Seeger Got America Singing. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Well, I write books for children, and I've done a couple of nonfiction books, actually three now, I think. And I had no intention of writing about Pete Seeger, first of all because he was alive, and second of all because I had two friends whom I knew were writing about him, and I certainly didn't want to step on their toes. But, you know, everybody gets old and everybody dies, and this is a really bad plan. I don't like this plan at all, and I was kind of hoping that Pete would beat the odds,
right?
Because he had been my hero my whole life, since I was a very little girl. I've listened to him for many, many, many years, and I knew that he would die someday, and I knew that I would probably find out some morning or other by turning on the news, and sure enough, I turned on the news that terrible January morning, and there were those banjo notes ringing out, and I said, this is it.
Yeah.
And I just started crying, and I just couldn't stop. And I cried and cried, and I listened to his music that day and the next day. And, you know, I guess because I am a writer, I started writing. I found that it was a way for me to work through grief and loss and a way for me to honor him and pay tribute to him. At least I hope that's what I would do. I didn't know how it would turn out, and I didn't know what I was writing, but I was just doing it and sort of shaping my story about him. So that's how it happened.
And the friends who were writing about him, were they writing children's books or?
Yes, the one that I know best was writing a book for older kids from about grades 4 to 8, and that book came out a year ago, and it's wonderful. Mm-hmm. And then the other one came out in, I think, the early spring, March, probably around March. And I told them both. And, you know, it's a cutthroat business.
Yeah, yeah.
It's really not. Children's book people are so nice and so kind and so respectful and so dear to me. And I just couldn't help myself. And we're all still friends. And these things happen. And it's not, there are so many books about Martin Luther King, and there are so many books about Rosa Parks, and there are so many books about Abraham Lincoln, and there's room for a lot of books about Pete. And these books are all very different. They do very different things. They have different audiences. So I think we're all happy.
Yeah, I think also most writers understand that, you know, the subject matter is not proprietary, not unless you're really taking a plot, but like the,
right,
the biography,
but, you know,
of Pete Seeger, that's not something you
right.
can, yeah, okay.
Right, but I wouldn't do it purposely. Let me put it that way.
Right,
it
you're not.
It was involuntary.
Yeah.
So
the title of the book is Listen. Well, actually, I wanted to ask you: is the title of the book what I first said? Listen, How Pete Seeger Got America Singing, or do you intend for it to be the other way around? Because that's on top. How Pete Seeger Got America Singing. Listen.
Yes, I intended it to be Listen, How Pete Seeger Got America Singing.
Great. Okay, yeah. And how did you come to that title?
I think we had a different title, which I can no longer remember because it was about 2 or 3 years ago. And then my editor said, once I arrived at the first sentences and it was clear what kind of voice I was using for the book, he said, well, why don't we just call it this, which is great because I have a lot of trouble with titles. Titles are terrible, especially for the writer, because the writer doesn't always know what she's written.
Right.
It's easier for somebody who reads the book cold to say, oh, I know what this book is about. So he suggested the title. And then the funny thing was, when I started getting the advance readers, the proofs, they had gone back to the old title, and my heart clutched, and I said, oh, no, didn't we mean to use this other title? And we all just laughed, because, yes, we had meant to use the other title. So it worked out well in the end. But, yeah,
now,
terrible with titles.
Would he say listen a lot when he was talking to people and singing to people? No, okay. No, that's you just encouraging the reader to listen about Pete Seeger.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. That was the voice I sort of came up with while taking a nice hot shower one day. Writing is not easy. I mean, it's not like coal mining either, but it's not easy. And you sort of sit down in front of the laptop, at least I do every day, and face your own inadequacies and fears and self-criticism and inabilities, and you struggle with finding the right voice, and every time you put down a word, you can put down any one of 100,000 other words after it, and it's, you know, what am I doing?
Right.
And so often I will look for a good first sentence, and a good voice, a good path, and if I get that, I consider myself very fortunate, and it helps me shape the story. And this one really did come to me in the shower. There was nobody like Pete Seeger. That listen, there was nobody like Pete Seeger. And I thought, now I've got it. Now I have this kind of authoritative approach to telling the story. I've got this. I'm going to tell you this story all about him. That kind of voice.
Yeah.
Which is sort of what he used when he sang songs, when he would sing of working people or whatever, you know, the story songs that he sang. He was more or less that kind of person.
Yeah, I liked the way that you did seem to let his musical style influence the prose in this book. The example that really stood out for me was when you were relaying the story of how he had to appear before the House Un-American Activities Committee,
mm-hmm.
And you describe how he was in trouble with them, and then the line is, "What trouble? This trouble," and then you go on to explain what the trouble was, and it was like, that was so very lyric-like. I loved that.
Oh, thank you so much. I didn't have, that one didn't come too hard. That one just sort of came.
Yeah, okay.
Sometimes, you know, you're just, I've read this about writers and I've often not believed it, but sometimes you're just a conduit. The words come from I don't know where, so you're just doing it. And then other times it's like pulling teeth. And I've had teeth pulled, so I know what it's like.
But I think also finding the voice through, you know, having found that kind of authoritarian, is that the word you used? Listen.
Authoritative,
not authoritarian, sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah. That would help you, you know, channel or just sort of let the story come through you, I would think.
Yes, that's what I was aiming for.
Now, one thing that I really liked is that he ages through the book. He's a little boy at the very beginning, and then, you know, every single page it's sort of a chronological tale to some extent. But I liked also just seeing the arc of this life. I thought that that reflected well that you were inspired to do this after he died, maybe.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And, of course, a lot of that is the work of the brilliant illustrator Raul Colon, who created those gorgeous pages of him aging.
Yeah,
And I thank him so much for doing that.
Yeah, it's a beautiful, beautiful book. Were you familiar with his work before learning that he would be your illustrator?
I was familiar with his work. He's quite well known in children's books. He's a really prolific illustrator. He's done a ton of books. He's won awards. I don't know if you know how children's books work. It's a very odd system, but in most cases, unless you're very famous or have a tremendous amount of pull or sold a lot of books, the manuscript is submitted and you might not see it again until the book comes out.
Right.
So the editor chooses the artist, the art director and the editor work together on the manuscript and the pacing and the illustrations, and I might not see the book. So I was really happy that my editor, Neil Porter, asked me what I thought of Raoul, and I said I'd be ecstatic. And I did see a couple of illustrations along the way. The theory behind separating us is that they don't want writers to tell the illustrator what the writing version of the book would be.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, my dog isn't that color or something like that. But I find it a roadblock in some ways, because if I were to work with the illustrator, once I saw the art, I could take some of the words out because the art would do it. And since the picture book is supposed to be a perfect blend of art and text, then it would be, to me, a more creative act.
Right.
But maybe when people trust each other more, those things will happen.
They're
going to trust you.
I went and looked at pictures of Pete Seeger, you know, just to sort of reacquaint myself with his mm-hmm. face. I haven't seen him in a while, right? And I thought that, mm-hmm. that Raoul Colon did such an amazing job. I mean, these illustrations are not necessarily representative. They're beautiful, but they don't look like photographs. But he really
right.
captured his expression and his face.
I think so. And, of course, you don't want them to be photographs.
Right.
You want them to be evocative of the person. I don't know how illustrators do it. I really don't.
Yeah, yeah.
And the three books on Pete are so very different that he looks different in each one, and yet they're all Pete.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
And the fact that you're using his name so comfortably reminds me that he had a huge influence on you. It's not just that you were a fan. You actually sort of followed him. Well, it sounds like you had a very early influence from him, and then you also went to marches and concerts. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that.
Sure. I grew up in a very left family, and I grew up in Southeast Washington, D.C.,
mm-hmm.
And my parents were familiar with the Weavers and the Almanac Singers, which were groups that Pete was a member of.
Mm-hmm.
And they were familiar with the music of Woody Guthrie. And they were also very committed to interracial justice and justice and equality for all. And the rumor is, everybody's dead, so I can't really completely substantiate this, but I've been told it by a number of people, that they helped start the first public interracial nursery school in Washington, D.C.,
mm-hmm.
and that Pete came and sang there. And I would have been there, so I would have been 3 or 4.
Oh,
and,
cool.
Of course, my other friends from that era, some of whom are still around and we're still in touch, none of us remembers it, but we're pretty sure it happened. We've heard it.
Yeah.
And then I went off to summer camp for various reasons, not least among them that there was a polio epidemic in Southeast Washington, and both my parents worked, and we didn't have any money, but they sent me off to this camp where folk singing was one of the major things that happened, and we sang Pete Seeger songs and Weaver songs and Almanac songs very early on, and I grew up with them.
Yeah.
And then I saw Pete. I got to see him a bunch of times. And yes, as you say, I did march behind him. I did hear him on demonstrations. I consider myself very fortunate to do that, to have done that. And then the very last time I saw him was at the Champlain Valley Folk Festival. And I can't remember when it was, but maybe 8 years ago, mm-hmm. maybe 10 years ago. And he was picking up garbage after the festival. We were helping to clear up some stuff. And he and his wife, Toshi, were picking up garbage, and I finally said to myself, it's now or never.
Right.
And I went over to him, and I said the thing that probably he has heard 10,000 times. I said, Pete, I just need to tell you how much your music has meant to me, and I've loved you my whole life, and, you know, the blithering sort of things that people who are a little starstruck say. And he looked at the sky, and he sort of had his garbage picker upper in his hand, and his wife took my hand and said, he really does appreciate it. And then I remembered reading in a Rolling Stone interview from about 1972 that he was being interviewed in a cafe in Berkeley, California, and the same thing happened, that a woman came over to him and dropped a note on his table as she was leaving. And it said, essentially, I don't want to interrupt you. You look like you're having an important conversation, but I just want you to know how much you've meant to me. And I thought, oh, my God, he's gotten thousands of these. But it can't hurt, and
no.
It really is true. I spoke from my deepest heart, so
did it,
I'm glad I had a chance to say that.
Did it hurt your feelings that he didn't respond, or?
Oh, no.
No.
Oh, no, not at all, no. He was reputed to be socially a very shy person.
Yeah.
And it was really Toshi who made Pete's life possible. She made it possible for him to do everything he did.
Yeah,
okay. The unsung hero of his life. And he said she was the brains in the family.
Yeah, no, that's
so
great.
You know, the fact that she said he really does appreciate it, that was very thoughtful of her.
Yeah. Now, I think that one thing that this book will do is better acquaint young people, very young people, with activism and the idea of sort of standing up for what you believe in. I wondered if that was part of the reason that you wrote the book.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Yeah, okay.
Although it wasn't why I started out writing it. I mean, I started writing it to tell his story. But as I was writing it and things were getting worse and worse in our country, I thought, well, of course, let's tell young people how much one person can make a difference. Let's see if they can understand how wonderful group singing can be. Let's see if people can get off their cell phones and take to the streets and see what change can look like. And right around that time, things were starting to heat up and the presidential election was getting going. And it didn't look so good for a long time, and it doesn't look so good now.
No.
So, yes, I definitely hope that it will encourage young readers to see the power that they have together and individually.
Yeah. What is the age that this book is envisioning as readers? What ages?
I never know what age I'm writing for. I leave it up to the publishers and the review journals, which have said everything from grades four up. So I did read it to some very little kids last week, and they were totally clueless, but they were really good at clapping when we sang. They were great at clapping, and they were like, you know, 18 months old, and mostly they just wanted to run around and eat crackers. And I think, ideally, I think a child around 6, 7, maybe 5, to be read with a parent, 6, 7, 8, because there is some heavy stuff in it. There's the pollution of the Hudson River, there's the story of the House Un-American Activities Committee, there's Pete Without Work. So it's not just a light, fluffy book about kittens.
Yeah, yeah. And then I wanted to just ask, what are your thoughts about how young people express their activism these days?
I think I love the Women's March. I love the fact that we're out there all the time now. It does seem to be slowing down a little bit, but I expect it will pick up. I think that I've heard from a lot of younger friends who have said that they're being radicalized by what's going on around us, and I think that's wonderful. I think we need the young people out there because I know for me, for one, I am old, and I can't march as much as I used to. But I call people every day, and I know people are on the phones, and I know they're sending emails, and I know they're signing petitions. And what I'd like them to do even more than that, or along with that, is, as I said, hang up their cell phones and start singing.
Yeah.
Because the civil rights movement, for example, really was energized by singing. Women and men sang in jail. They sang as they marched. They sang during hard times. They sang during rainy nights when they were out protesting. The songs of the civil rights movement still have that power, and Pete was instrumental in that. Pete was one of the people who brought We Shall Overcome to the masses. So I think we really need to have those group songs and those choruses that can energize us and give us heart and keep us marching.
I think there's also in the sing-along, not just singing, but the sing-along where everybody's together, there's great power to bring people together across, you know, some sort of philosophical divide, because I think right now everything is so divided, but we do have these songs, you know, and we have them in common, if that makes sense.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And we need new songs. We need young people to be writing. I know they are. I just don't listen to as much as I should because I'm busy writing all the time.
Yeah.
But I know that there are people out there doing really good work, younger singers, energetic singers, rap. There's a lot of stuff.
Now, I know that you've played traditional music all your life.
I have.
So what's your instrument?
These days I'm playing guitar. Over time I've played backup piano. I've played banjo. I learned how to play banjo from Pete's book, How to Play the Five-String Banjo, sitting in my bedroom with my little banjo. And, yep, I did, as did many, many other people. It's still in print.
Yeah.
And I moved on to guitar, and then I played fiddle for a long time. But recently I've picked up the guitar again over the last 5 years, and it really is, it's such a beautiful instrument, and it can really do anything. And I'm finger-picking old country blues, which is sort of where I came in a long time ago.
Now, do you write original compositions as well?
No, no, I don't. I don't have that gene. I wish I did. Pete wrote a lot of songs. You know, he sang his own songs. He sang other people's songs, and he sang traditional songs. But I don't have that.
Yeah, okay.
And there's a lot of good songs out there. I don't need to have more.
Yeah. I loved in the book how you used song titles to kind of hearken us back to his music. And it made me wonder about the permissions that you had to get in order to use. I know you can't use lyrics. I've gone down that road myself in a book. So
I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's awful.
Yeah.
So can you just talk a little bit about that? Do you not need permissions to use song titles?
No, titles are free and clear, but I wanted permission to use some lyrics. Initially, I had appropriate lyrics connected to each section of the book, such as when I discuss how he and Toshi built their house. I had quotes from Kisses Sweeter Than Wine, which is all about the life's journey.
Right.
And I engaged in a lovely year-long conversation with the copyright agency and with the family about getting permission to use the lyrics, and as you say, it's not a fun experience. But I finally did get permission after the year, but it was too late and it was way too expensive.
Mm.
So we decided to use song titles instead. And in fact, I'm happy with the way it turned out, because as you read it now, or as I read it now, especially with kids, I stop and I sing. And I say, let's all sing this song. And it's a way to teach them the songs with choruses and to get them involved and have them clapping and whatever else. And I think it worked out pretty well.
The other thing that occurred to me as I was reading it, and I don't know if this is why you or the illustrator made the choice of doing this, but the song titles are all in blue, as are hyperlinks. Mm-hmm. It reminded mm-hmm. me of being online and wanting to click on a hyperlink to further investigate. It made me wonder if that was the impetus for making it blue, to kind of encourage people to further investigate the songs.
Well, Shayla, you are the first person to mention that, and it's a brilliant image. I hadn't thought of that myself. I think that's great. I'm sure that was the designer's decision, although it could have been the editor's and the illustrator's. I'm going to ask them right away. But I think it was to highlight the songs and to differentiate them from the text, because when you read it aloud, you can't really tell unless...
Right.
I mean, if you don't know the song titles, you might think it's part of the text. But it was a brilliant decision, and obviously, now that I'm looking at it that way, it was even more brilliant. Thank you.
You're welcome. Well, I think it will help to encourage people to look more closely at his music.
Mm-hmm. And I do have a website which has links to a lot of the songs and the music.
Okay. All right. Great. Now, I did read in your bio that you, I think, were a history major.
What?
And so I wanted to ask you about doing research as a writer.
Uh-oh.
What?
I'm losing you.
Oh, am I gone?
Oh, now you're back.
Okay. I'm just going to make
it. Okay, now I can hear you.
Okay, huh. All right. Well, that's important. Being able to hear each other is very helpful.
Yeah.
Let me just write that.
You were just saying I did read.
Yeah. I read somewhere that you were a history major, and I wanted to ask you about doing research as a writer and maybe doing research just sort of beyond the internet, which I think a lot of people rely on Google these days. But what do
yes.
you do?
I love doing research. I would rather do research than almost anything. And I didn't even realize this until I started writing nonfiction, because, of course, it's not the same research that it was when I was in college. It's way more fun.
Yeah.
So I can get lost doing research for days and days and days. And I basically have taught myself how to do it. And I think I am the world's finest researcher, if I may say so. And if you want to know anything, just email me. I've learned how to use not the hidden web, not the dark web, but the databases that aren't common. I use the New York Times all the time. Archival New York Times articles, the Washington Post archived, Google Books, images, you know, the Wayback Machine to find articles that have been taken offline. So I do use the internet a lot, but I also buy things on eBay, and I buy magazines on eBay, and old articles that you can't get any other way, and it's just endless. It's so much fun. And then when I sit down to write, I have to forget that I've done it all and just tell a good story.
Yeah.
That's the hard part.
That is hard.
Yeah.
Now,
have you done research?
Yeah, I have some of the work that I'm working on now, some of the fiction that I'm writing has to do with the outcome of the Spanish Civil War and sort of what it was like being in society in Spain after the war. So, you know, I've tried to do a lot of research about that, and sometimes it's hard and sometimes it's not, but it's always interesting. So,
have you read the Hochschild, Adam Hochschild's book? Spain in Our Hearts?
No, I haven't.
Oh, you should.
Spain in Our Hearts.
Spain, yeah.
Okay, that's great. See, there you go. okay, let's see now. I wanted to ask you, after the House Un-American Activities Committee and the outcome of that, which took many years, he was blacklisted from certain events and he had trouble finding work. So what did he do for work during that period of time? This would be in the 50s and 60s.
Right. He basically lost his major sources of income, and he went to the smaller outlets, to coffee houses and schools and colleges and camps, and he put together work for himself over that difficult time. And the interesting thing to me about that, when I think about it now, because I was one of those kids that heard him during those years,
right,
is that he really created a whole little army of kids who knew his songs and who believed in the words and who understood the words. Like when he sang a song, Which Side Are You On?, we went to find out who those people were. We wanted to know, what were these Union battles? What were these places that he was talking about? Or the 1913 massacre that he sang with Woody Guthrie? What was that all about? So we became more knowledgeable, and we learned all the songs, and we were ready to take to the streets.
Yeah.
And when he was able to work again, and when the blacklist came off, and when the Vietnam War began, we were out there because we had been trained. We had been taught. I'm not going to say brainwashed, because it certainly wasn't brainwashing, but we were educated, and we were ready to join the resistance, such as it was back then, the anti-war movement, the ban the bomb movement. We knew the songs.
Yeah.
So, you know, and you would meet your friends traveling somewhere, and you'd say, hey, do you know this great song I just learned from Pete or from one of the other people who were like Pete, although nobody was like Pete? And they would say, no, teach it to me. And so you'd pull out your banjo and you'd teach it to them. And it was kind of this great little underground of folkies.
Yeah.
And I think he had a tremendous influence that he might not have had if he had just stayed in the larger venues. Now, this is my theory. I don't know if it's really true, but it's my theory. I like it.
Yeah, I like it too.
Yeah.
Now, as we already talked about before, you had personal interactions with Pete, and he clearly influenced you greatly. Were mm-hmm. you ever tempted to use more of your personal story in the children's book text? Or you have a great...
No.
Oh, okay. You have a great afterword where you talk a little bit about your own interactions.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
No,
so,
not in this... Yeah, I've tried to write, like everybody has, a novel. And you've actually succeeded where I have not. But they always say your first novel is basically your memoir. And I did try that, and it was very unsuccessful. So I'm not going there again.
Okay. now, let's see. I did like, in addition to the afterword, you also included a wonderful timeline of his life. I felt a little bit like this was for your readers that were maybe a tiny bit older and would want to do some more research on him. And it's just fabulous. You've got a little bit about every decade, and in some cases more than a little bit about every decade. And a couple of my favorite moments, you have this wonderful thing from the 1930s where he wrote to his mother in 1933, and this is a quote from his own autobiography where he mm-hmm. includes the words that he sent to his mother. Do you think that I should spend $15 or $20 of my savings in the bank to buy a good banjo with a nice tone and everything? I'd like to a lot. And honestly, I think that it would be worth it because I'm awfully interested in the banjo. It's so cute. And it goes on and he talks about wanting to dance while he plays. And I just loved that.
I just loved that. I'm so glad that you had resonance with that. I loved that quote. I was hoping to get it in somehow, so I did.
It's wonderful.
I just imagine this little boy, you know, he was 12 or 13, writing to his mom and said, can I have a banjo, please, Mommy? And look what happened to him. I mean, he became probably the preeminent known, well-known banjo player of his time. Not the greatest, but people, when they think banjo, they would think Pete.
Yeah, yeah. And his parents and stepmother were all musical people as well.
They were.
Which was interesting.
And his siblings as well.
Right.
His brother Mike Seeger, his sister Penny and Peggy, and his sister Peggy, who is still with us,
yeah,
who is still making music, just released an album recently.
Huh. Wow. And then
yeah,
another item on the timeline that just blew me away was that he joined the Occupy Wall Street protest at the age of 92.
He did.
And he marched with demonstrators. I just thought, wow, that's amazing.
I know. And there's a video of him on YouTube doing that. He was on crutches at the time. I'm not sure why. And it's just amazing. And he was singing. And, you know, he couldn't sing in his last few decades. I'm not sure. I can't remember exactly when he lost his voice. He could still speak, and he could sing badly, and it never mattered. And somebody asked me the other day, why do you think he could, why could he get people singing like that? And I don't have a clue.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it wasn't charisma, it wasn't talent, it wasn't, he just did it. It was just the expectation that he had that everybody in the room would be singing in four-part harmony, and all he had to do was raise his hand. And it worked. And I've been in millions of concerts, and nobody else has ever done that.
Yeah.
It just worked.
Now, you're saying that about other people's concerts reminds me that I wanted to ask you, can you think of any contemporary singer or artist or activist whose work achieves anything like what Pete Seeger achieved in his own time, like on a different scale, because we're in different times, but...
Well, as the second sentence of the book says, there was nobody like Pete Seeger.
Right.
So I'm not as up on younger people as I should be, and by now I really should have found some. But I am told by people who know things that there are some people who are galvanizing audiences and who are leading the charge. Most of the people that I know of are not young anymore.
Yeah.
So I don't really know who's out there in their 30s.
Right.
You know, I know of Billy Bragg, and I know of people along like that, but I don't know of younger people.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
I should make that my research project for the next few weeks.
There you go. That'll be fun.
Yeah.
What did you think, if you were aware of it at the time, of Dylan's famous electrified set at the 65 Newport Folk Festival?
This is a great question. Go ahead.
Well, I've heard varying stories about this, but supposedly it really upset Pete Seeger that he you know, played in front of this electrified backup group. So I'm wondering what you thought of that.
Well, it's very funny that you should ask this, because I used to go to the Newport Folk Festivals. I went in 1963, I went in 64, and I am convinced I was there in 65.
Oh, really?
And I'm convinced that I saw that concert. I remember it. I remember what Dylan looked like. I remembered the black leather jackets, etc. But I asked my boyfriend at the time, from the time, if we were there that year, and he said, no, I don't think we made it. But I remember it so clearly. So I am the perfect example of, if you remember the 60s, you weren't there. But there's a whole book called Dylan Goes Electric that I've read. And really what I think Pete was doing was that it was just too loud and he couldn't hear the words. Because Pete was a very strong supporter of Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
He always encouraged him. He sang his songs. He thought he was an amazing performer and musician.
Yeah.
So I think it was really, and there had been electric performers at Newport before. I think what I've taken from all the things I've read is that it was just too loud.
Yeah, yeah.
For that crowd.
Yeah.
And yeah, but it's a great apocryphal story, whatever it is.
Okay, great.
And someday I'll find out if I was there.
You're going to have to find old photo archives and see if you can find yourself.
I do look. Yeah. Whenever I see pictures of Newport, I say, am I there?
That's funny. What was your publication journey like with this book? First of all, do you have an agent? And secondly, you know, how did you go about finding a publisher?
I do have an agent, and I had worked with this particular publisher, Roaring Brook, and its editor, Neil Porter, before on a book about Marcel Marceau.
Oh, right.
So... and also another one about borscht. So my agent sent it to Neil first, and Neil said, yeah, it needs some work, and here's the work it needs. Make it sing. So I went back to the drawing board, but it didn't take too long. So he accepted it, and we never sent it to anybody else because Neil does great picture books, and if I could work with him on every book, I would.
Okay.
And now that I've said that, I should amend it to say, I'm happy to work with any other editor who wants to work with me on any book.
I'm very easy to work with.
Yes, just to cover my bases here, I'll work with anybody.
Okay, great. So what are you writing now? Are you writing something new these days?
I am working on a biography, a picture book biography of Harry Belafonte, which may or may not ever be published.
Wow.
Because you never know, but... I, again, had not intended to write about him, although I've certainly followed his career as well. And it's kind of weird because in many ways he's so much like Pete that it's hard to differentiate them. And in other ways they're very different because, of course, they have very different stories, backgrounds.
Yeah.
So I hope this one sees print someday. I admire Mr. Belafonte enormously. He's an incredible human being. And I don't think very many people know about the work he's done.
He's still with us, right?
He is. He's 90.
Okay, yeah.
And he's still gorgeous.
Yes, yes, yes. I think he was he made some famous appearance in the last few years, maybe on the Oscars or something. And I remember thinking, my goodness, he's still got it.
He's still gorgeous, I know. You know, my husband always says, boy, if men talked about women the way you people do, we wouldn't get away with it.
Yeah.
I say, I know. Well, we can because we're girls.
We're girls. But, you know, the equivalent girl who I would have said just looked stunning all the way through was Lena Horne. Wasn't she beautiful all the way? Okay. And then I would also like to ask what you've read lately that you might recommend to any age reader, not just children.
Well, I'm a huge fan of this young writer called Anthony Mara, who wrote The Czar of Love and Techno.
Okay.
And A Constellation of Vital Phenomena.
Oh.
And I think they're both incredible books. Very dark.
I've heard of the second one. I haven't heard of the first one. So.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
And I read Annie Proulx's very long Barkskins, which I thought could have been a little shorter, but it's a whole history of the destruction of the forests in the North America, and that was horrifying. What else I read? One of my favorite books that I've read recently is a very small book called The Greenhouse.
Okay.
By an Icelandic woman whose name I won't even try to pronounce.
Okay.
And it's a beautiful little story about the confusions of a young man coming of age, and I just loved it.
Yeah.
What else have I read? Read a lot of books that I didn't love. You know, I read books these days, and I put them down, and I think, why did I read that? What have you read?
Oh, wow. Nobody ever asked me that.
Well, see?
I just read, Listen, How Pete Seeger Got America Singing. It was great.
Thank you.
I'm reading David Budbill's Broken Wing right now. I'm enjoying it very much.
Yeah. So sad to lose him.
Oh, I know. So sad. All right. I just have one last question for you, Lita. And actually, I got this question by reading another interview that you gave, where you advised writers of children's literature and YA to spend time reading books with children, not just reading children's books, but reading books with children. And I found this a really interesting piece of advice. Can you talk about what you gain in doing this?
Well, I mentor an 8-year-old every week at our local elementary school as part of Everybody Wins, and it's really interesting because I spent my life in children's books. This is what I've done. I was a librarian. I was the school library consultant for the state. I've read thousands and thousands of children's books, and when I look at her, and she's bright, and she's funny, and she's interesting, and I look at the books that I've loved, I think, no, she's not going to like this. She's not going to like this. So it really helps to sort of read with children and get ideas about pacing and character, and not to write what they want necessarily, not to write books about princesses and unicorns and all that, but to pay attention to what it is that's below the surface.
That sounds great.
Yeah.
Wonderful. I think that's great advice. You often hear people say, well, you have to read, you know, you have to read the books that are being written, but I think reading with them, that makes so much sense.
Especially with picture books, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And,
it's been a real learning experience for me.
The writers of adult literature don't have that ability. They can't really read with their audience and see what they like. You can go to Goodreads and read what people thought, but it's different.
Don't do it.
Yeah, no, it's a bad idea. Lita, I'm going to step out of the interview for 1 second and just let you know we're going to say goodbye and then stay on the line if you don't mind.
Okay.
So I want to just mention one more time that the name of the book is Listen, How Pete Seeger Got America Singing. It's a Roaring Brook Press publication, a Neil Porter book by Lita Schubert with pictures by Raul Colon. And I want to thank you so much, Lita, for speaking with me today.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. It's like sitting around with a brand new friend. So thank you so much for having me, Shayla.
You're listening to WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and that was an interview with Vermont author Lita Schubert. You can read more about her work at litaschubert.com. This week's Write the Book prompt is to read with a child. Do you have young children? A niece? A nephew? A grandchild? Maybe you can volunteer to read at your local public library. Watch how the children react to what you read. If you write children's books, this will help you understand what appeals to young readers. If you don't, then use the experience as inspiration for a poem, a story, or an essay inspired by your experience. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. And you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. Stream the show live each week at 99.3wbtv.org, Mondays at 3. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book on WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week.